You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 31st, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author Michael Hastings, author of The Operators, the wild and terrifying inside story of America's war in Afghanistan. He wrote that piece in Rolling Stone, I guess, a year and a half ago, The Runaway General, which led to the firing of General McChrystal. Also on the program, Okfo Show, the live streamer from Oakland, who has been covering the Oakland Occupy, or Occupy Oakland encampment movement on the weekend's massive arrests in Oakland. Also, later in the program, she called in, I guess, a month or 2 months ago from Occupy Oakland. She was one of the first people arrested in that raid on the Occupy encampment.
October 26th.
October 26th, says Matt. And so, should be quite a program. Meanwhile, Dawn lights on Marblehead as the EU leaders, according to the New York Times, set to conclude austerity is not enough, which apparently is a polite way of saying austerity is exactly the wrong thing. Employment numbers, growth just devastated in Europe because of this 16-month-old march to austerity. It's not working. Also, later in the program, probably in the better half of the program, two Brits detained and kept out of the United States for tweeting that they plan to come to the United States, get drunk, and dig up Marilyn Monroe. I think that's a true story. It's been reported in multiple British newspapers. The only thing that seems to be a joke is that they weren't really going to dig up Marilyn Monroe, but we will get into that in the after show. And speaking of after show, folks, for thousands of you, you listen to the show on a regular daily basis, some of you maybe three times a week. Now is a great time for you to become a Majority Report member. Now, more than ever, we need your support. And I mean that both metaphorically and actually literally. So if you can become a member, it is, again, I think I said this yesterday, jingle around your pocket. Is there a quarter there? Is there also a dime? Two nickels? Put that on the table. Look at it. Is that precious? Is it as precious as the sound of my voice right now? Because for 35 cents a day, you can ensure that the Majority Report continues. And you also get the bonus of an extra 50 minutes a day of programming. Or a free DVD. Not or, and a free DVD. So definitely worth it. And then at the end of the month, after you've accumulated that 35 cents every business day, you'll actually get change back. I know, that's a shocking, shocking deal. Completely unaffected by inflation, and for that matter, deflation, I guess. The price of a Majority Report membership has remained constant for almost over a year now. So, ladies and gentlemen, please, if you have the opportunity, the wherewithal, please become a member today at majority.fm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Michael Hastings, author of The Operators, Rolling Stone journalist, in just a moment. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program author Michael Hastings, author of The Operators, the wild and terrifying inside story of America's war in Afghanistan. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Now, for those people who do not remember your piece in Rolling Stone, which I know is just a few, but we try and bring along the stragglers here. The piece was The Runaway General. It recounted your time essentially embedded, not with the sort of the classic embed where a journalist rides around with military personnel in the field, but you embedded yourself essentially with the command of JSOC. Well, was he commanding JSOC at that time, or recount for us that story.
No, so General McChrystal was selected by President Obama in June 2009 to go over and take over the war in Afghanistan. And McChrystal had been the head of JSOC for, I believe, something like five of the previous 7 years, and JSOC, of course, being the most elite, you know, terrorist hunter organization that the U.S. government has.
And so people should know this is the Joint Special Ops
Command. Yeah.
And the book is essentially it expands on this piece, both in terms of your the players surrounding McChrystal, and also sort of the dynamic between the press that ostensibly covers the military, the Pentagon, and in fact, I guess in some respects, doesn't simply cover them, but in some ways sort of functions as a promotional arm for the military.
Right. They're essentially enablers. The original headline for the story was The Runaway General. This book's about the runaway military. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot, and people have talked about it as a book about Afghanistan. And, of course, there is that element, but it's really a book about the United States in the past 10 years of this sort of decade-long war. And who are the types of guys, in this case men, who end up running the show after your country's engaged in these sort of long forever wars? And the answer is, as you sort of alluded to with JSOC, in McChrystal's case, it was, you know, our most notorious killer who had been involved in all sorts of cover-ups with Pat Tillman, the NFL football star. He was involved in that cover-up, was involved in all the sort of torture camps that were set up around Iraq. And rather than, resigning in disgrace because of those things, he kept getting promoted. And he ended up with one of the most high-profile job in the military under Obama.
Yeah, let's start with the half of the book, essentially. I mean, I don't know if it's that really. It's fair to say it's that discreet. But let's start with McChrystal and the insight that you gained, sort of the way McChrystal perceived the civilian command, the way he perceived other generals, because it really has implications on what the Afghan policy has been.
Sure. I mean, to get a sense of General McChrystal, I'll just sort of give you a quick story about my first conversation with him. So I had flown over to Paris to begin the profile, and I walk into this, five-star hotel in Paris, and General McChrystal's there. And the first thing I get introduced, this is the Rolling Stone guy, and then he says, "Well, I don't care about your article, son. I just want to be on the cover of Rolling Stone." I said, "Okay, well, that's great, General. It's between you and Lady Gaga," just kind of as a joke. He said, "Yeah, put me and Lady Gaga in a heart-shaped tub, and we'll go from there." And that was, I was like, wow, these are different, these are really different kinds of guys. Within 12 hours from that conversation, I was in a briefing where General McChrystal started making fun of Vice President Biden in a briefing in front of, a dozen staffers. And then his top advisors, one of his top advisors, now sort of what got them in a lot of trouble, he said, "Biden, did you say bite me?" And it went from there. That was the beginning of the trash talking to their civilian masters. And the reason why, as you pointed out, why it's critical towards our Afghanistan policy, these are not just offhand comments. These were comments that represented a contempt towards the civilian leadership that the military had, and that played itself out in policy, because rather than respecting the president's orders, essentially, they had no respect for them, so they went and basically did what they wanted. And specifically, President Obama said, "I don't want a 10-year nation-building commitment in Afghanistan," and General McChrystal and General Petraeus gave the president a 10-year nation-building plan.
I don't think that this can be emphasized enough. I mean, you have a put in context the notion that a guy who comes from special ops and the sort of the mentality that's involved in special ops, as opposed to someone who had come up through the more traditional branches of the military, because this is important both because the military, our defense budget is reflecting more of an emphasis on this special ops emphasis as we go forward, to the extent that, that much money can really have an emphasis on one thing. Sure. As opposed to another. But it also talks about their perception of themselves within the context of the military, their level of discipline, and their perception of just what they can get away with.
Well, exactly. One of the issues that actually doesn't get talked about much is that there's quite a lot of tension between special ops and sort of regular armed forces, right? The regular armed forces look at the special op guys as, these guys don't respect authority, they never ask, they think they're the hottest thing on the planet, et cetera, et cetera. And so the sort of special op mentality, they're called snake eaters. That's one of their nicknames. It's this, we're bad, risk-taking, highly trained, we're the most highly trained military force that's ever been on the planet. I mean, this is their sort of attitude. And what that has allowed them to do, and again, I go back to General McChrystal's case, is that to get away with things that would have killed anyone else's career. I mean, Sam, if I was interviewing for a job and I asked you, "Well, how many cover-ups of famous NFL football players have you been involved in?" And you said one, you know, the death of one, you know, you wouldn't get the job. In fact, you'd be in jail and I'd be in jail too, probably, you know. But instead, McChrystal, because he was so able to push the envelope with this special forces attitude, was able to sort of rise through the kind of post-9/11 chaos, friends with Cheney and Rumsfeld and everyone else.
But it goes beyond just sort of like a cockiness, right? I mean, we're talking about people who are fundamentally, in some respect, trained in a different way than those who come up through the ranks of the non-special armed forces. Because, I mean, they're trained to react and to, I guess, freelance a lot more than one would if they had grown up with, if they had been trained
sure.
with sort of a much more fealty towards the chain of command.
No, that's exactly it. I mean, special ops guys pride themselves in sort of being free-thinking, able to operate. I mean, they call them the title of the book is from what they call themselves, which is special forces operators. You know, they're able to operate on their own in the most intense, extreme environments with very little oversight. So you put a guy like General McChrystal and his staff, who are made up of these special forces guys, ahead of on top of big army. You know, the more traditional armed forces. And it shouldn't actually come as a shock that of the things that General McChrystal said that he actually said, because this is the culture and this is the sort of attitude it breeds. In the book, I make a comparison, and you know, some may accuse us of being hyperbolic, but the movie Apocalypse Now. I don't know how familiar your listeners are with it, but I compare, you know, how we view McChrystal versus how we view Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now, who is also this sort of assassin. And in Apocalypse Now, Colonel Kurtz is sort of, you know, thrown as an outcast, you know, in the banks of Cambodia. You know, flash forward 30 years, and Kurtz is the one who's running the war.
And so how did it come about? I mean, in terms of Obama, I mean, he was how did he end up hiring McChrystal, and what did it mean when he ended up firing McChrystal?
Well, I've said this before. The mistake was not in the firing, it was in the hiring of McChrystal. And the reason why he hired McChrystal, basically he didn't really know the guy, and he just took, and President Obama took the advice of Admiral Mullen, Secretary Gates, and General Petraeus. And they said, you know, this other guy over there, this guy named General McKiernan, he's no good, he's a dud, he's a loser. This McChrystal guy is the hottest thing around. You need to put him in. Remember, he hired McChrystal after only meeting him for about 10 minutes, you know. So President Obama was relying heavily on the advice of the Pentagon. Now, we have to remember, the Pentagon is not Obama territory. You know, this is an organization that for the past three Secretary of Defenses before Panetta were Republicans. During the Bush years, it was the hotbed of Republican, you know, activity towards the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, of war, in, especially in Iraq, which Obama was very vocally against. So I think what had happened, the president essentially relied on people who didn't necessarily have his best interest in mind.
And this gets to, well, before we get to that broader point,
sure.
I want to, because I think this also, this notion of the almost like a sense of intimidation in some respects,
mm-hmm.
Before we get to that, because I think that also dovetails with perhaps, I don't know, the way that the press, the Pentagon press covers the Pentagon. But before we get there, the McChrystal's people and in general, the feeling of Petraeus is far different than the sort of the notion that we are told to have about Petraeus as being this sort of shining white knight.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of tensions between Petraeus and McChrystal's staff, and that plays it itself out in a lot of different ways. First, there's a competitiveness about who deserves the most credit for Iraq, and also you know, the White House was very afraid.
And we should stop here in saying that
sure,
that
sure.
People see that as a positive, like who deserves the credit
oh,
for
yeah. Oh, yeah.
For it going well, I guess theoretically.
Yeah, see, exactly. Theoretically, the illusion. Who's successful for convincing the idiots in Washington that we won in Iraq,
right.
Which is a total lie. But that's besides the point. But this is where the tension of these guys come from. So there's this sort of rivalry. I think, you know, General McChrystal obviously, you know, respects professionally, General Petraeus, and they've been very close in terms of how their careers have evolved. But the main thing, you know, one of these sort of interesting things, I call it Petraeus envy, and this sort of led into the situation with McChrystal, where what Petraeus had done masterfully was to get essentially his own fan base within the media. And what he was able to do with that fan base was to circumvent the normal chain of command, and in fact push his policies and his ideas through the media and to put pressure on various sort of policy-making apparatuses in Washington. And you know, so McChrystal gets in charge. McChrystal, you know, takes over this war in Afghanistan, and he tries to do the same thing, right? He tries to be on the cover of all the magazines. He tries to be on 60 Minutes. He tries to sort of develop his own media fan base in order to better protect him and push the policies that he wanted to push. And in the end, it backfired.
I mean, in some respects, the fact that they allowed you and allowed you to embed with them is a function of that, right? I mean, McChrystal, this is at a time where McChrystal is essentially trying to bypass the normal sort of bureaucratic chain of command and take his to sort of gain some type of like media cachet where he could use this into sort of a further, in some ways, bullying the president in some ways, right?
And well, they did it. That's how they got all the troops they wanted. It was this total full-on media campaign. So, you know, McChrystal saw that and said it was successful. But what's even crazier about them agreeing to do the interview with Rolling Stone is that they were agreeing to do an interview at all with any major magazine. The White House had warned them not to do this sort of stuff. You know, and then so you have to ask, what does McChrystal get if he gets on the cover of Rolling Stone? You know, what is he really getting out of this interaction with the media? And I think the only answer is, the only logical answer, yes, you want to reach the sort of demographic of Rolling Stone, but also to create this sort of invulnerable, you know, celebrity general image that would then, you know, in theory, this again, it sort of backfired, would make it safer for him to do what he wanted to do.
And in fact, in the book, you wrote that there are essentially there's essentially a Pentagon marketing team made up of nearly 27,000 people. Draw that out for us.
Sure. I mean, it's that 27,000 number. It involves, you know, advertisers, public affairs people, global communications strategists. I mean, there's a whole office in the Pentagon about, you know, it's called something like global strategic communications, you know, and they're morons. That's why they need 27,000 of them. But it's still, you know, this incredibly expensive media campaign that's constantly being waged against the American people to convince them that what they're doing, what the Pentagon is doing, is good and proper and right. And we've seen this play out over the past 10 years, where the Pentagon has never said we're losing a war, right? They have never come out and said, oh, we're losing in Iraq or we're losing in Afghanistan. They always say we're winning. And, you know, so how they have any credibility at all, you know, shocks me.
And to a certain extent, so McChrystal is thinking, like, you know, McChrystal's aware that there's this massive apparatus, and anybody who has been involved in any type of media business knows that, you know, if you get out there and you are getting any of the coverage, that's where this apparatus will gravitate towards and will,
exactly,
will play off that type of coverage.
Sure, and it's very deliberate. You know, when after General McChrystal got to Kabul in the summer of 2009, he invited over an assessment team, you know, of outside quote unquote experts to help him, you know, design his strategy, or at least that's the idea. Now, but made up of this panel of experts to help him design it are all these people who write op-eds for the Washington Post and the New York Times, and who have very influential blogs. So, and who work very closely with all the major national security journalists in Washington. So essentially, McChrystal's almost putting journalists directly on the payroll, though they're think tank guys, but there's sort of this blurry line, brings them over, says, oh, hey, thanks for all the help, guys, and, you know, helping us figure out the strategy, though in reality, McChrystal kind of had a pretty good handle on what he wanted to do. Then all these cats go back to Washington, and start putting the word out that, oh, we have the strategy, you got to give McChrystal what he wants. Op-eds start appearing in the Washington Post, New York Times, 60 Minutes, on all the major influential national security think tanks, all get on the same page. And so you have the White House, which is, sort of under assault from various leaks and whatnot, but having to deal with this sort of intractable media narrative that McChrystal and his friends had already set up, which is, if you don't give McChrystal the number of troops he wants, then we're going to lose. And you, Obama, first-term president, one-term President Obama, young, doesn't have any military experience, we're going to exploit that as your weakness, and we're going to get what we want.
Did the firing of McChrystal, which I think is, at least in modern times, I mean, maybe it happened, I don't know, 50 years ago, but it's
right.
it's one of the first times that a president, certainly in my lifetime, has fired a general in the field.
Yes.
Did that represent a shift in Obama's relationship with the military, or in just his own sense of confidence?
I think it did. I make this case that one of the sort of brilliant moves that Obama has actually pulled off since becoming president is to take back control of the Pentagon. Now, how deliberate it was is another, you can speculate on. But look, Panetta's there. Panetta is a Democrat who did well by him at the CIA. Petraeus is out. Petraeus is defrocked. He's no longer a four-star general. He's running the CIA, still very powerful. But once you become a civilian again, you lose some of that cachet. And McChrystal is gone. There's no more celebrity generals. General John Allen in Afghanistan is not on the cover of Time magazine. It is not going to be. I think the firing of McChrystal wasn't just about the Rolling Stone story. It was sort of a three strikes and you're out situation and a representation of just how frustrated the White House had become with the Pentagon.
And so now I want to turn to the other sort of really interesting story here that your book tells and the reaction to your initial piece tells. And I got to say, I recently read a play that I think is going to be on Broadway soon about the Alsop brothers, and specifically Joe Alsop, who was a the modern day equivalent to
like a Tom Friedman, I guess,
maybe a Tom Friedman ish, but also sort of he was a guy who was at Vietnam who saw guys like Halberstam come in and felt that Halberstam was ruining things,
right,
because he was he was not on the side of America. He was not on the side of the generals, according to this reporter. And that dynamic of this notion, because you were attacked by many war correspondents, writers, for ruining the relationship. I think it was Burns at the Times who said,
yeah,
that you ruined it. And then he later admitted that there was stuff that you tell this story, that he had a story that he never reported.
Oh, yeah.
Situation,
yeah.
It was devastating.
Yeah. Oh, it's really incredible. Now, John Burns, I don't know how familiar you are with William S. Burroughs. He reminds me, he's like the war correspondent version of William S. Burroughs, sort of this like old kind of junkie who needs war to survive. But besides that personal attack that I just launched, there's sort of a substantive critique of John Burns. And look, he's a multiple Pulitzer Prize winner. He's a serious guy, and a guy, when he attacks you publicly, it's saying something, right? He's not someone who's going to weigh in on just anything. And, what was amazing was that besides attacking me on air, he wrote this blog post. And right after the story came out, he wrote a blog post in the New York Times where he said, in 2004, General George Casey, who was then commanding general in Iraq, asked him, said something like, "I don't think we can win, or do you think this war is winnable?" Now, this is an amazing moment, right? Remember, 2004 in Iraq, the commanding general asking a reporter whether, basically saying, "I don't know if we can win this thing." Not off the record. It wasn't off the record. But just sort of said it, and Burns didn't report it, right? Casey would then go on to sort of oversee what was considered the most disastrous 18
Hold on, folks. We got a little bit of a problem. We'll be right back. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is our technical difficulty music. Sadly, we have had a complete and total failure of our internet.
The whole building, too, right?
I mean, the whole building has lost internet. And so it's not simply us. Well, it's just our provider, I should say. Part of the limitations that we have here at the Majority Report, the juggernaut sometimes sputters. This is the first time we've ever had this type of catastrophic failure. It was, I guess, inevitable on some level. And it's a wonderful time for me to reiterate just how much your support matters. Another 10 members a month, and we could afford a second internet backup. 15 members a month, and we could have actually a legitimate phone connection into our office. And then even beyond that, then I wouldn't get backed up with other attempts to find other work to supplement this. I wouldn't call it a hobby, but it's one of the jobs.
Maybe one day we'll have enough members to start our own internet service provider.
Let's not get carried away. That probably would not be. I will endeavor to reconnect with Michael Hastings in the near future to finish off that interview. The interview we did, though, was fairly substantial. I'll do one story before we go. And hopefully we will be fixed by tomorrow. We have service technicians who I'm sure are just scrambling across the city right now to help us out. But this one story, it's a lighter story, and one that I certainly on a day like today could use to lighten up a little bit. Lighter unless, of course, you are these people. Just to give you an example of – it's a wonderful – this story is a wonderful view into just how demented this country has become in some respects after 9/11, and also just how much scrutiny is paid to what we tweet, what we put on Facebook perhaps. I don't know about LinkedIn, although I'm sure – and any other social media. This coming from the British press, the Daily Mail. Now, I suppose this could be a hoax. So let me just preface this story from the Daily Mail with maybe they've been duped. Because this story is so ridiculous. Two British tourists. Kids now in their 20s. Entering America on holiday, as they call it in Britain, which is another way for saying vacation. They tweeted about in excitement of them coming to America. They tweeted, Lee Van Bryan on his way to America, tweeting to his pals about his trip to Hollywood. Free this week for quick gossip prep before I go and destroy America. Apparently that is British slang for get drunk. You know, like when people say, like, dude, you were ruined last night. You weren't actually ruined. You just got so drunk. And they also said, like, get ready, L.A. 3 weeks today, we're totally in L.A., pissing people off in Hollywood Boulevard and digging up Marilyn Monroe. So apparently the Department of Homeland Security, which has been setting up false accounts on Twitter, they screen Twitter for sensitive words like illegal immigrant, outbreak, drill, strain, virus, recovery, deaths, collapse, human to animal, Trojan. So they must have tracked this guy saying something about Marilyn Monroe. Federal agents searched their suitcase for shovels, claiming that Lee's friend Emily was planning to act as Lee's lookout while he raided Marilyn Monroe's tomb. Apparently, these two dangers to America were not bright enough, according to these federal agents, to realize you can buy shovels in America without a permit. Because remember, folks, it's people who dig up Marilyn Monroe, not shovels. They spent 12 hours in separate holding cells with apparently drug runners from Mexico who are in there for cocaine smuggling. They wanted to know what we do. According to the girl, I almost burst out laughing when they asked if I was going to be Lee's lookout while he dug up Marilyn Monroe. I couldn't believe it because it was a quote from the comedy Family Guy, which is an American show. They did a full body search on her, apparently, to see if she was hiding a shovel in her buttocks. After 12 hours, they returned the two to the airport, where they were handed documents which stated that they had been refused entry into the United States. Emily's charge sheet stated, "It is believed that you are traveling with Lee Van Bryan, who possibly has the intentions of coming to the United States to commit crimes." There was a mugshot and a fingerprint added. He had posted on his Twitter website account that he was coming to the United States to dig up the grave of Marilyn Monroe. Also on his Twitter account, Mr. Bryan posted that he was coming to destroy America. They just said, "We wanted to have a good time on a holiday." That was all Lee meant in his tweet. He wouldn't hurt anyone. So careful what you tweet, folks. And ladies and gentlemen, that will be our show for today. Hopefully we will have this posted by the end of day. Or we will go to some remote location to post this show. Remember, if you can't afford to become a member of the Majority Report, email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and when we get the internet back, we'll be able to work something out with you. You can also support this show by going to our site. If you buy any junk through Amazon, you can buy it through our Amazon link, majority.fm. Click on support the show. JustCoffee.coop. 10% discount using the coupon code MAJORITY. Fair trade coffee, tea, and chocolate. But look, at the end of the day, folks, we need your memberships. We needed your membership before we had this problem today. But we need your membership even more. So if you can spare the change, please do. Every little bit helps. We'll be back tomorrow, probably reviewing the Republican primary race and also with Okfo Show and all the rest of the Occupy coverage we were planning to do today. They shall not stop the juggernaut! Completely, anyways, on a weekly basis. See you tomorrow.